CF United, the premier Cold Fusion Conference by TerraTech Programming. Created by developers for developers.
Welcome to 10 Things You Should Know. Before we get started, a little bit about myself. My name is Joe Reinhardt. I'm a consultant at a consulting firm named Booz Allen Hamilton that's located about 5 miles down the street here in Tyson's Corner. My business group provides enterprise-level Cold Fusion development and support for both commercial and government clients. If you ever have any need of any services along that line, please feel free to let me know. I'll be around all week. Second, I'm a blogger at clearsoftware.net. It's my own little website where I talk about Cold Fusion, best practices, object-oriented programming, and of course the Model Glue framework, of which I am the author. A little tidbit on the side is I wrote my first conditional code back in about 1985, telling a little turtle where to draw on the screen and logo. Great little old programming language. If you know me, you know that I tend to start speaking really fast. And if I get going too fast during this presentation, or you can't read code that's on the screen, or you need me to just slow down a bit, don't bother raising your hand or anything on that line. Just yell out, "Hey Joe, can you slow down?" And I will, no problem there. The format of our presentations, and this is a format I do in most of mine, is that we do the PowerPoint talking head with some demonstration activities mixed in, and I try to cut it short usually by about 10 to 15 minutes to give us the opportunity to do what I call reach activities, which is a term straight from the Scrum programming methodology or project management methodology, where we choose a few things that are real-world activities and applications of what we've been talking about so we can see the friction where concept doesn't meet with reality and get some practice using new tools, and also give us time for a nice question and answer period. What are we talking about today? Well, first, we're talking about best practices, things you should do every time you open a code editor. Second, ways to better ourselves as developers. We should have an interest in continually improving ourselves. Third, and I don't mean these terms in any kind of offending way, but professional versus amateur software development. And last, of course, making our lives easier, tools and techniques you can use to reduce your headaches daily. Where am I drawing this material from? Well, first, it's from a series of blog entries I wrote a long time ago that was covering 10 different best practices. Second, from my own personal professional experience in the terms of mistakes I've made and had to learn along the way. Third is my professional exploration and application development. I really like what I do. In fact, I spend usually an hour to 2 hours a day doing a little bit on the side just to keep learning and to keep on top of new technologies. And last, job interviews. Especially one of the things we're going to go over are questions that people sort of continually get wrong in job interviews and questions I've been asked that have floored me when I've been in job interviews. How's this talk going to help you? First, we're going to see some free open source tools you can use both for yourself and your entire project development team. We're going to look at some techniques to improve your day-to-day software development. And we're going to, of course, give the answers to some common Cold Fusion interview questions that are also competencies everyone should be aware of and be able to perform. A little bit of a warning, I don't mean to go off in any rants during this, but I will be pointing out a few mistakes a lot of developers made. I won't be pointing out any mistakes that I have never personally made. What's important is that we learn from our mistakes and make ourselves better developers in the process. So yeah, get on with it. Let's move on to the first thing you need to know. And the first one, before anything else, if you're doing web application development that's database-backed, is to protect your database. How many people in here do not know what a SQL injection attack is or how to prevent it? Show of hands. Okay, so we've got about 10% that definitely need this first thing to know. Before I keep going down the road of the other 10 things, I'm going to go take a few more polls. How many people here do not know what a cross-site scripting attack is or how to prevent it? Excellent. Can you keep your hands up? And people for SQL injection, hands back up. Okay, how many people here do not use source control? More hands. Do not use issue management. Okay, now for the one that gets everybody. Do not use an automated build tool to deploy your sites. Okay, so everybody's getting something from this presentation today. On to thing to know number one. If you're developing a web application, you probably let people enter data. It's kind of a given. If you're not server-side validating this data for both type and content, you are, in fact, letting your customer down. your user's data can do some really vicious things to your application and your database. Using things like manipulated URLs or even just text area inputs, a lot of people could probably alter, edit, or delete the data in your database that you didn't intend them to, or even run arbitrary code against the command line of your server. Not a good thing to have happening on your web application. What do you mean they can alter other data? I write SQL statements. I put variables in the statements. That's what the statement does. Well, a lot of times, that may not be everything your statement does. The altering data and the real SQL injection portion of this tends to occur when you've dynamically built your queries instead of parameterizing them, basically using variables inside your query. And this is a rather innocent-looking example that a lot of people are probably familiar with, where I'm saying CF query, data sources news, select everything from articles where category ID equals URL.category ID. Is this familiar to a lot of people? What's missing? Exactly. What would happen if somebody ran the URL at the bottom here? Article ID equal 2, semicolon, delete from articles. Well, that would go straight into your SQL statement. It would all be interpreted by your SQL server or whatever you're using on the back end, and it would run the select statement and then run the delete statement, wiping everything out of the table. Definitely not a good situation. So as a lot of people shouted out, what can you do about this? Well, the easiest way, because Cold Fusion is all about easy, is through a tag called cfQueryParam that says this variable value that I'm about to place into my query is not executable SQL. It's simply a placeholder that will contain a value later on. The value that is passed to the cfQueryParam tag can't contain SQL code that will be executed. The same query rewritten using cfQueryParam is still very simple. Select everything from articles where category ID equals, okay, we're using a parameter now. This is not executable SQL. It's not script. It is only a value. The second way you can prevent against SQL injection attacks is to simply use stored procedures. Write your SQL, compile it on your database server, and then just call that procedure from your Cold Fusion code. With a stored procedure, instead of any script living inside of your Cold Fusion, parameters are just passed in, and then queries and sometimes other parameters are passed back out of your stored procedure. The same query, again, rewritten using probably a cfstore proc call, you see that there is no script in this. There's no script being generated by Cold Fusion and sent off to your server. So it's really hard to add more arbitrary script to a script that doesn't even exist in the first place. Now, the other thing I mentioned, and I really just mentioned this one to scare some people that are running Microsoft SQL Server, is this concept of SQL injection actually running command line commands. Microsoft SQL Server, in a lot of its licensing deployments, exposes an extended stored procedure called XP command shell, which simply says anything that comes after this stored procedure call, go run it at the command line. So if you're not using cfQueryParam and cfStored proc, and letting your users, through whatever they put into the form or the URL, add SQL to your statements, they could probably run something like this. index.cfm, category ID equal 2, exec master XP command shell, and then whatever they want. In this case, writing the string owned right into a text file. They could open up ports on your firewall, install a keystroke logger, write their own user into the system, really whatever they want at this point. So to summarize, the first thing you need to know is prevent arbitrary command line code and arbitrary SQL from running by using both the cfQueryParam and cfStoredProc tags every single time you ever write a Cold Fusion query that involves a variable value. Yes, you do lose the ability to use the cached within and cached after attributes, but those are typically most useful in queries that aren't variable anyways. Now, the second thing to know is along the same line. This deals with the cross-site scripting attacks. Data entered by your users can be used to steal other users' information through what's known as a cross-site script, or XSS attack. Probably the most common way this occurs is through a text area, where you allow your users to enter freeform data into a text area box somewhere on a page. You then allow other users, including yourself, to read what they've entered just by CF output whatever was in there. Is this common? People do this? Okay. Now, in this common scenario, imagine a feedback form from a shopping cart that you've just deployed for a customer, where users can go and enter feedback into a text area, Whatever they enter is stored into the database using cfstoreproc or cfqueryparam, so they can't add extra SQL there. But then administrators can log in and read the feedback that's just been entered. What would happen if this was user feedback? And it's really a jumble of code of script I've tacked onto the end. So they've said, I'm probably going to wander off camera, your site is great. Script, create an AJAX request, send off all of the current users' cookies to my own server, and then take them back to where they're supposed to be. So now I'm an administrator logged into my system with full administrator rights, and somebody else knows my CFID and CF token. So they can go open their cookies, change the values to my CFID, CF token, browse to the site, and they're me. They have access to my site now. They are an administrator. This obviously needs to be prevented. And Cold Fusion, just like SQL injection, makes this a very easy thing to prevent. There's a function for it called HTML edit format that takes any string content and escapes all of the HTML from it. So if somebody enters a script tag or an object tag or a class tag, it's simply displayed to you. In short form, it takes less than and greater than and turns them into ampersand LT semicolon and things like that. In Cold Fusion MX7, there's also a feature called Script Protect, which is a bit beyond the scope of this, but just know it's a feature, it's there, you can turn it on, and it will help almost server-wide cut down on cross-site script vulnerabilities. Both of these play into thing to know number three, which is a very common both software development and systems administration principle called the principle of least privilege. SQL injection and XSS attacks are both really fine-grained examples of ignoring this principle that states that any process, be it a SQL statement or a server process, should execute with the minimum access level needed to perform its own operation. A very common example is how you install Cold Fusion. How many people here have Cold Fusion running under a system account on their production servers? Okay, we've got some hands. So the majority of people here create a new account on the server and run the Cold Fusion user under that? Excellent. The reason for this is Cold Fusion, the process itself, shouldn't be allowed full access to your server. It shouldn't be an administrator. You should only turn on what it needs to know about, like directories it could write to. So if somebody figured out how to change where files are being uploaded, they can't go uploading executable files into something like the startup directory. That would just be bad. Okay. I actually work with one developer who I'm okay with the principle of least privilege. I'm not the biggest zealot on it, but his practices have really turned me around in this principle and made me a better developer, where anytime he creates a new data source in Cold Fusion, he creates a new user just for that data source to use, which is a good practice that a lot of people do, but he turns off access to anything inside of every database. It can't even run a select statement against any table until he writes code that needs to perform that select statement. And at that point, he'll go create, in his DDL language, a grant statement to grant access to that table. He's the only person that I've seen pass my company's internal audit process without a single revision to his code. Following this to a T can really solve a lot of security problems. So I talked about security problems that were SQL-based, and we're going to move off of security, but stay with SQL for a moment. And that is simply that basic SQL is very powerful. Is there anybody here who's been writing Cold Fusion and SQL for probably less than a year? Okay, good, good, excellent. SQL can be used to do a number of chores that a lot of people unnecessarily use Cold Fusion to accomplish. And what follows now is a series of really simple SQL exercises that I tend to do in a job interview. Job interviews in my company are split into like four parts where I think I'm normally part three, where I come in and I'm just technical. I don't talk about where people went to school or anything along that line. And the first thing we do is we sit down and we go through this exercise and see how far we can get. Where we describe a basic table structure, we have two tables, student ID and name, and then grade with grade ID, student ID, and grade. So one student simply has many grades. The first thing we ask for is, can you get all of the grades for an individual student? Can you return a query that just has two columns, the student's name and then a grade they got? So a single student like Gary would probably have four rows if he has four grades stored in the database. Does everybody here feel that they can write this in one SQL statement? Okay, a couple hands went up, so I will stop and go through it real quick. Well, we're going to use just a simple join from table to table. It states we want to select data from two tables, relating them on one or two or any given number of columns inside those tables. In this case, I'm saying select the student's name and the student's grade from the student table related to the grade table by s.studentID equals g.studentID. So that's the simple one. That's pretty much a no-brainer that we're going to get through that. The second is, can you write a query to get the average grade overall? A query, not a query and then a CF loop with addition and division. Everybody comfortable with this? No, just average grade overall. Okay. Everybody's comfortable with this. We do start to have some fall off on this question usually. And that's asking people if they're aware that the database servers typically have things known as aggregate functions built in, like AVG, to select the average of all the values in a given set. In this case, the query is very simple. Select the average grade as average grade from grade. There's a second thing we start looking for in this question, and that is how people think about and organize their code. Do they go ahead and name this table, or because it's an interview question, they just write average grade, knowing it'll bring back an unnamed column? It's still always a good practice to see that people are thinking about the use of their code down the road. In this case, that column is going to need a name, seeing that as average grade shows a little further thought that's put in and care for the code. Now we get on to the question we had here, which is where it starts to fall off pretty significantly a lot, unfortunately. Can you write a query that returns each student's name and their average grade? Is there anybody in here who doesn't feel they could sit and do this in about 30 seconds? Okay, great. What we're going to do is basically combine those last two exercises we did, where we joined the two tables and ask for the average grade. But in this case, we can throw in another column into our SQL clause called group by, which, if you're doing reporting, is really one of the handiest things standard SQL provides. It's worth 5 or 6 chapters in any SQL book. In this case, select that value, joined between these two tables, and group it by both the student ID and the student name. So we're looking for join plus aggregate function plus grouping. The hidden things that we're also looking for are, again, that column naming. And a lot of times, people will simply, because they're only getting the name back, group by the student's name. And what's the problem with that? Anyone? Exactly. Two students with the same name start sharing the same grade. When you're grouping, always group by something that's unique first. And now the last one that we get to, and this is still using one query, can you get every student's letter grade, knowing that 100 to 91 is an A, 90 to 81 is a B, and so on, all the way down to E? Is there anybody in here who's not comfortable doing this, again, in 30 seconds or less in SQL? Okay, more hands as we go up. This is where we can do something that a lot of people don't see often, which is using a case statement up in your select clause. In this case, I could add this case statement to my select clause, case when, and you can actually do case statements on an aggregate functions result, such as switching on the average grade per student in this case, stating that when the average of the student's grade is greater than 90, go ahead and give this column a value of A, and so on down to E. Getting a lot of stuff done without having to go back and do script to add and then figure out, or add and then divide and then figure out the letter grade. Just doing everything in SQL, because SQL is very good at relating and sorting basic string data. Java and ColdFusion, simply that's not their job, so they're not the best at doing it. Now, you've noticed in my SQL examples, I'm actually kind of strict on how I format my SQL. That's because this is one of my biggest pet peeves in a lot of software development, is not formatting code. See, a lot of heads just started going like this. Great. Writing code the first time is absolutely never as hard as editing the same code later. How well you can look at a piece of code that was written 1 week, 1 month, or 1 year ago and understand how it worked can be a lifesaver as you go further down the software development lifecycle. Simply formatting your code up front, spending 1 or 2 minutes doing it, can save you hours later on. The first tidbit I have on this is match existing style, if there is an existing style. Teamwork shouldn't really win over personal preference. I personally can't stand CFScript. I don't honestly understand why it still exists. I was kind of hoping it would be deprecated. But as a consultant, I often wind up working in other people's code where everything's written in CFScript, and then it stops and uses tags when CFScript falls down, and then goes back to CFScript. But I need to match this, because when I leave the project and other people are working on it, that's what they're used to seeing. So that's what I do. A second tidbit is that some people, who especially are new to ColdFusion, don't know that you can block indent your CF tags. If you have a CF tag like CF pizza or more real world, CF LDAP or CF mail, where you may have 7 or 8 attributes, they don't all have to be on the same line going off of the side of your CF Eclipse IDE. Instead, you can drop them all down into a new line and then close your tag later on, making them much more readable. It's easier to read these key value pairs scanning down than scanning right. A third one is my CF script tidbit. Either use CF script or don't. Switching between the two can actually be really hard to read, especially in ColdFusion. Well, only in ColdFusion where we have CF script. And in this case, we see that we're using a tag to create an object called foo, and then we're dropping over to CF script to do something with foo. And then we may need to do a query, so we're going to go back to CF tags. And then we need to manipulate the query's results, so we're going to go back to CF scripts. And you wind up with one file that has these two different, completely different syntaxes in them going back and forth over and over again. It becomes very hard to read. The goal of this tidbit isn't completely about CF script, but it is about standards and having one and using it. Commenting your code. Commenting your code is very important and oft forgotten. Commenting, actually, it's a very simple concept. It has taken me a long time to learn what needs to be commented and what doesn't. Variable names sometimes are, even when the variable name is very descriptive of what it is, the hardest thing to understand. At the top of modelglue.cfc, there is a cfset statement called cfset variables.listeners equals struct new. And it's very cryptic to know what this does, looking at something called listeners. It's an abstract concept. So that concept is actually explained really quickly when that happens. Message listeners contains references to CFC methods that subscribe to messages. Okay, now I know when I'm working with variables.listeners exactly what that thing is. An example of a not so good comment is commenting the obvious, or what everybody knows is about to happen. Add one to foo. Foo equals foo plus one. Thank you. That was another line of code that we didn't need to scan over to find the real bug. One thing that's often left out from formatting, and this is unfortunate, is SQL. For some reason, people don't like formatting SQL. And I think that's because sometimes people come from other languages where it's much harder to format, such as ASP, where you have to actually build your whole SQL string line by line and then send it off to the server. Well, inside of a CF query tag, you're in free text mode. You can enter whatever you want. So it's very easy to go ahead and format it. This SQL statement is kind of hard to read. It's getting some columns from a table aliased as C, and then it's joining a few tables, and then it's grouping by some other things. And it's got a few things wrong. Its select statement is just run on until it has to wrap. All of those joins are just in line. It's using table aliases that make no sense. I guess A dot is the first table we ran into, and then we needed a second table, so we created B, and so on. Where this is a world of difference. It's the same query, just formatted. All of our columns are in a nice vertical line, so we can just scan down, and if we need to, really quickly count the number of columns so we make sure we've got the right number of TDs displaying this query later on. The table aliases are very sensible. Orders O, order details OD. You can have two-letter table aliases. It's not a crime. It could be any string you want. The joins, I can see I have three tables involved. I have three clauses right here in the from area. And then group by is another sensible list. Formatting your SQL can really save you hours because a lot of times the hardest bugs to find are the ones in unformatted SQL in the experience that I've had. Which takes me on to a little bit more about source. How many people here do not use a source control system? Great. I'm going to call on somebody at random who raised their hand to tell me why. Can you tell me why? Back there raising your hand? Oh, sure. You just volunteered. Okay. Never had a use for it. Complication or cost or? Number of developers. Okay. 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 Would having a source control system that was free and absolutely mind-numbingly easy to use change any of that? Okay. We'll take a look at one. I want to see if it does. My take on it is that there's absolutely no excuse, despite any excuses that have been thrown up here, for not using a source control system on every single project. I like source control so much that I run Subversion locally on my laptop. This PowerPoint presentation was developed under source control. So if I threw out a slide and decided I want it back, I could flip back five versions, get that slide, put it back in my current version, and commit it again. Because it's very easy to use Subversion, and we'll talk about that more in a minute. What a source control system is, however, is a piece of software that allows any participant in that software to view a snapshot of your entire project's source code at any given frame of time or any stage and revision along its development path. And that instant could either be a physical date or a specific revision number. Let me see it after 44 revisions have happened. One thing that I ran into recently and added to this slide was that source control is not file names. I worked on an application a few weeks ago where if a developer wanted to change a file, they took the base file, renamed it, appending the current date and time they were working on it to the end of the file, and then made their changes and tested against that file, renaming it back to the base name, making sure it worked, then renaming it to the thing with the date and time added. And then when it became time to deploy the application, somebody stayed up all night, taking all of these files, taking the newest one, lopping the date and time off the end, and using that version, and then having to run a link checker to make sure all the links still worked. And it was absolutely crazy when there's no excuse not to use source control because the two best systems in the world, in my opinion, are absolutely free and easy to use. And that is Subversion, which is still relatively new, and coming along as a replacement for another system known as CVS, which has been around for, I believe, a little over 15 years now. Subversion is an especially easy to use with an ongoing active development environment. Its clients, Subversion itself is just a server and then a set of executables that you can go run at your command line. So people are on their own to write clients for it. And some people have done a very nice job with things like Tortoise SVN for Windows, which I'll show later on in our reaches. And there's also great online resources for working with Subversion. Is everybody here familiar with O'Reilly Press? White Books, Animals? Yep. Okay, they make the book on Subversion, that's the best book, and they publish it absolutely free online. If you Google Subversion book, you will get this book in return. Two links that I will leave up here for a minute for everybody to write down are subversion.tigris.org. They provide all of the installers for Subversion. It works on OS X, Linux, Unix, Windows via a Windows installer. It takes about 5 minutes to set it up on Windows. And also tortoisesvn.tigris.org, which is my favorite Subversion client. I actually don't use the plugin for Eclipse for it because I like just working at my file system level. And what that is a client that goes right into your command shell, where if you want to update a file or save your changes back into the repository, you just right-click the file and it's a new option in there. Just commit my changes. And we'll take a look at actually doing that here in a little while. Okay, thing to know number 7 is this concept called issue management. How many in this room do not use issue management? Hands up. Okay, good. A formal issue management system is another sort of telltale difference between this professional development environment and sort of the we've learned as we went along development environment. And one of those things that everybody says, we'll get to when we have a break. When we've caught up with all of our tasks, we'll go ahead and implement one. If you're at that point, there's really no better time to do it than right now. So you can see what those tasks are that you need to get done. What an issue management system is a central repository that everybody can get to and access that tracks all of the problems in your current application development and oftentimes future requirements as well. What it is not is somebody's inbox. Unfortunately, that seems to be one of the most common forms of issue management. I was at another company recently where the project manager left, and the IT department wiped out that guy's inbox before anybody else could pick it up. And the clients had been emailing him, and he had like 2 years of history of everything that had gone on inside this project in this inbox that was now really in the Ethernet. It was never coming back. So again, there's no excuse for not using an issue management system if you want to use one. That's because there's, a number of free open source ways to accomplish this. Well, not open source all the time, but spreadsheets on share drives are a really simple way to share information. I have a few very lightweight projects we're doing, some using a project methodology called Scrum, where spreadsheets are actually the preferred way. We have one sheet that tracks everything that is currently backlogged in an application, and then we'll just create a new sheet for things that need to get done by a certain date and assign those tasks to it. We can all open it anytime, mark that it's done, mark that it's deployed, and then it goes into this log of things that are completed. If by that date we haven't finished everything on the list, it just goes back into the master list of things to do. A second way is through a custom solution. If you want to get better at protecting against cross-site scripting attacks and making sure you're good at protecting against SQL injection and maybe get a chance to experiment with source control on something that isn't going to a client, try to write your own trouble ticketing system. It's a basic CRUD application where people can come in, enter a ticket, it can be assigned to somebody to complete, and then assign something like a resolution status. This was fixed, it wasn't valid at all, we're not fixing it, it only happens to this one guy running Windows 98 on Microsoft IE3, so we're just not doing it. Anything along that line. And last, off-the-shelf systems. There's a few that are free that are very lightweight and very good. One is Ray Camden's Lighthouse project, which is written by Ray Camden, the same guy who brought us Blog CFC and one of the authors of the current Web Application Construction Kit. It's a Cold Fusion-based system for managing, assigning, and tracking the completion of trouble tickets. It can be used for anything from software development to running a muffler shop. It is that generic and that lightweight at doing its task. And that's available at ray.camdenfamily.com/projects/LHP. And all of the URLs from this presentation should also be present in your program guide to the overall conference. Also, if you need to copy them back off after I'm done with my presentation, just let me know. The second one, and this is one that myself and a lot of other of the framework developers for Cold Fusion are using, is a system called Track. And this is one of my favorite tools in the world now. It's a free, open source based application for managing trouble tickets written in the Python scripting language. It includes a wiki, so everybody using it can go ahead and define terms as they use it. And it also ties directly to Subversion. Tickets inside of Track can reference a change in the code, or vice versa. I can state that my change 41 has gone ahead and fixed ticket 67. Yes, I had a question?
Yes, if someone needs to know that Python.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
No,
you do not need to know Python to use it. I have never looked at Python before in my life until I downloaded it, installed it, and had it up and running. I did learn a little bit of Python because I wanted to customize it, but it's a scripting language. Hardest thing to realize is that in Python, you don't use curly braces. You use how far you've tabbed in and tabbed back out, which is really kind of strange to ECMA people. Thing to know number 8, beyond how you manage tickets and how you get code developed, is once your tickets are closed and your code's committed, how do you move it off to your server? I am probably one of the prime offenders when it comes to FTPing my whole application to the server it's supposed to be on, remote desktoping to the server, editing its properties or its application.cfm files, and forgetting to change the data source name, or the mail server IP, or something along that line. That's because there's often a number of these changes that have to take place in a number of different files. And sometimes, in my old and really dark days, I wouldn't even write these down. I just had a data source name. I can remember to do that. And I'd consistently fail to. That's where tools like shell scripts start to come in. It is possible to write operating system specific, like batch files on DOS, that can go through all these files and make these changes for you. But there is actually a series of higher level tools available now. And one, again, that's open source and free is known as Apache Ant. I've had a few people come up to me before this presentation and ask, is there going to be an actual Ant demo? And I sat up here at the start and cleaned out an Ant file. So yeah, I'm going to show Ant at work here, and it can really make life easier. What Ant is a way to write XML files that are simply like batch files that don't care about the operating system. There's a Java executable that reads your file, interprets it, and executes all the commands that it states. Commands can really be anything. There's a command for zipping, a command for copying, doing search and replaces through entire directories or inside of specific files. You can run command line commands through ANT as well. My typical ANT script for doing something like I used to screw up all the time, forgetting to change things, is a simple script that runs a number of commands, first checking out a specific revision for my Subversion repository. So we can make a revision and call revision 200 version 2.0, and we're ready to deploy that to our server. It's passed QA. When I run my ANT script, it will ask Subversion for all the code that is the 2.0 code and put it into a temporary directory. And then, depending on which script it is, I'll have separate scripts for things like production or staging or development. It'll go through all of those configuration files and make all those changes for me. And then when it's done, it will zip all of that up into a single zip file and then do a number of different things depending on what project I'm working on and what the requirement is. Sometimes it will commit that zip back into Subversion, so we actually have a central repository for all of our different builds, so that somebody on the deployment side could then pull that zip and just unzip it right onto their server. Sometimes that zip will be FTP'd off to another process we have running that automatically receives it, unzips it onto the server, and by running one script, we know we have a tested process that makes all the changes that need to happen that deploys it out into our server instantly. No, that's a separate... That's actually using binary web services to move things out to kind of odd production environments we have scattered. Things to know number 9 is to know your responsibilities as a Cold Fusion developer. A lot of us, myself included, got started in the late 90s. For myself, I had never written HTML when I got my first Cold Fusion job. I had to learn HTML as I learned Cold Fusion. That's because I got a job at a dot-com startup writing install shield scripts, something else I had never written before in my life. I was just a computer science student who'd work cheap. So Cold Fusion became a very easy way for me to start writing database-driven websites, which was a really hot thing in the late 90s and early 2000s, and I became very much self-taught. And I made a lot of problems along the way, like SQL injection and cross-site scripting attacks. And it came to a point where I had to accept that, well, I could get the job done. I could write a password-protected site that let people come in and edit database records. There were still a lot of things I didn't know. And it was my responsibility to actively find out what those are and better myself as a developer. Things that are really good to know, need to know right now, are Cold Fusion components. I get shifty now when I start writing .cfm files. I'm so used to writing .cfc files. That's sort of a phase we should all be looking to move towards, especially as object-oriented programming and object-oriented design become more important in the Cold Fusion development community as a lot of us begin to move towards Flex. That's because as you start doing Flex, there is no more .cfm. It's all .cfcs, which is all objects, which is a whole new world for a lot of us to learn. A great place to learn these things is from the people you work with. Thing to know number 10. You're all here today, so that's a very great step towards meeting the community. I've been giving this talk at CFUG groups, where that CFUG group is the only way anyone there ever interacts with anybody in the Cold Fusion community, and that's just because there's free pizza when they show up. So your coworkers and the members of this Cold Fusion development community really are your greatest resource. I've done Flash development, .NET development, Java development, Cold Fusion. Unfortunately, I did install shield work for a while. And Cold Fusion really has one of the best communities, Cold Fusion and Flash both, of development groups I've ever seen. People are friendly, willing to help, and a lot of the leaders within the community really push other people learning the same things they already know. Another way to approach learning from your coworkers and community members is to collaborate when you're writing code. Don't be afraid of other people seeing something and saying they might do it a different way, not a right way or a wrong way. I didn't write the Model Glue framework on my own. A lot of people looked at a lot of code I had written and had a lot of different ideas because my code worked in my environment, but when they started using it, they had completely different takes on what they wanted to do with it. And I had to realize that I couldn't understand everything the Model Glue framework was going to have to do to keep everybody using it happy and be okay with some other people contributing things that really were necessities within the framework. Now, thing to know number 11 that I'm sneaking in here towards the end, I know it said 10, but there was a number 11 that popped up, is the blogs. Who here reads all of the Cold Fusion blogs through Full as a Goog or weblogs.macromedia.com? That was maybe 10% of the room. The top coders in the Cold Fusion community, the Ben Fordas, Ray Camdens, and Sean Corfields, all write probably at least once a day on their own weblogs. Sometimes they're writing about things that are harebrained and off-topic, but a lot of times it's about what's coming up in Flex or in Cold Fusion, or a new technique they may have found out. And that's okay, they're sharing, but what's even better about their blogs is they read their comments, and they actively reply to their comments. You're members of a development community where the top members are open to listening to anybody and taking a few minutes to read about your questions, about their thoughts. I haven't really yet seen Ben or Sean or somebody like that completely ignore comments, unless they were comment spam for BMW or Volvo or something like that. Okay, that's the end of the 10 quick things I wanted to go through. Because this is a one-hour presentation, I couldn't do the full like eight-hour version of this where we go through everything in a real serious boot camp style. Hopefully that's inspired you with a few things that you're not familiar with, a few new tools that you could look into using in your day-to-day development. And now we're going to shift over to some of these reach activities where we look at these in a little more depth. And the one that I really wanted to touch on first was using these tools of track and subversion. So I saw a lot of heads nodding when they saw me talking about tickets referencing each other. And to do that, I came in here earlier and made sure that we actually do have a network connection working in here. I know it's been kind of hard this week. And what we're looking at is this site called track.modelglue.com. Is anybody in here not familiar with the Model Glue framework or not heard of it? Okay. Is there anybody in that same group who's not familiar with Fusebox? Okay, only one. So what these are frameworks and pre-built code to help both organize your business logic and what's going to display on each of your pages. I've written one called Model Glue that seems to be getting some good use these days. And this is the track website for that, where I'm tracking all the problems in my current new version I'm working on. This is a ticket that came in from Sean Corfield saying that nested quotes in modelglue.cfm break on Blue Dragon 6.2.1. He's an Adobe guy helping out Blue Dragon, but I'll overlook that one. And we can see that he's entered a nice description for me. This is that trouble ticketing system we were talking about, stating that, yes, they break. This line in modelglue.cfm fails on Blue Dragon, and it's because Blue Dragon can't handle the quotes inside of pounds to do complicated expression evaluation on this specific version. I got this ticket that's come in. It's not currently assigned to anybody. If I go down, you see I have a note. I say, thanks, Sean. I plan on doing a Blue Dragon 7.0 test when I have time, or I'll just have spare time in a presentation to go ahead and fix this ticket with an audience. At the bottom, you can see that I have options for what I can do to this ticket. It's a lot easier to see this at like 1024 by 768, but we're at 800 by 600 right now, so we can't get a bird's eye view of this page. Where I can have things I can do, I can say what component it's a problem with, what priority I want to give it. I'll say it's actually kind of a high priority because Blue Dragon's here and they've been talking to me all week so far. It's no longer a feature request. It's something that I'll fix for the public beta too. And I'll go ahead and accept the ticket, assigning it to myself. Track has a number of pre-built... Oh, great. This is wonderful. Is everyone here seeing the screen sometime this week? But using the network connection and suddenly you're not. Track has a number of things built in, such as reports already, where I can see all of my current tickets by their status, which releases they're assigned to. I can see the SQL that's used to get that report, so I can modify my own reports or run ad hoc SQL against its database. Yes, please continue. I am now connected. Excellent. If I can go into my View Tickets view, I'm now looking at a list of all active tickets, everything that's on my to-do list. Color codes them quite nicely for me. Highest is in red. I can go through this and look real quick for the Blue Dragon. Okay, back at this ticket we were working with, ticket number 70. Now it says that modelglue.cfm has this problem. Track is really nice in that it ties directly into Subversion. There's a navigation link at the top called Browse Source. If I click that, it's going to take me to the source code repository this is actually attached to, and I can start browsing the source of my application through my browser. So get the trunk, which is where the main source code is. I know modelglue.cfm is in the modelglue folder, actually down in the Unity folder underneath that. So this is just like going through the directory structure of my application. Okay, modelglue.cfm. I haven't even had to go over to my code editor yet. And I can look through it and say, okay, get file from path, expand path, quote, quote. Yeah, that's where Blue Dragon's going to have a problem, right there. I can go into CF Eclipse or any editor of my choice and open this file up as well. Change this expand path to use single quote, hit save, and now we'll take a look at Tortoise SVN, which is my Subversion client, and just how easy it is for me to go ahead and commit back into my repository. That directory now has a red exclamation point on it, meaning that I've changed some code in there that isn't back in my source control. It's kind of easy to see. Oh, there's another red exclamation point here because I changed that file. Right-click it, Subversion commit. Say fixes ticket 70. I probably didn't fix all of it, but that'll just be another ticket later on. Click OK. Now it's sending back this back off to the Subversion server that's off actually running in Portland, hosted by Simeon Bateman for me. And it says, OK, I've modified, I'm sending the content, and it should be back in source control as revision 186. You're going to go back to track and back to that ticket real quick. On this ticket, I'll now add a comment. Partially fixed in change set 186. Submit my changes. It's almost like blogging about this specific issue. Now I have a comment, and because I used a special notation in there with brackets around it, it knows to link this to whatever this mythical revision 186 is. And what was that? I click it, it'll take me over to a diff of what I just changed. I can go through my browser and see what has just changed in this file. One line changed, the red line's the old line where I had double quotes, the green line's the new line. I can take any trouble that's come in from a user, and if I follow just a simple system of committing back to track and putting some comments in with what change set, my manager can go in and see, oh, that's what was fixed to get this. Or if I have something else break along the line, like say this actually didn't work at all, and I wanted to see all the changes that have happened to this file, modelglue.cfm. Click and it'll take me back to the source. I'll go into its revision log. How many times has it been changed? Well, these are all the different changes. Well, change set 186 fixed ticket 70, 162 fixed ticket number 2. It's kind of late fixing ticket number 2. Click that. It shows me that diff as well. So it gives me a round trip audit process for problems with my code and resolving those problems. I can start with a change in the code and see why it was made, or see a request for changes to happen, like a bug, and see the changes that were made to solve that problem. Okay, so the quick Dime Store tour of track, just that nice audit process and ability to track changes along with Subversion. The other thing I promised some people in here I'd show is Apache Ant and this Ant thing at work. A couple of heads just nodded again. Okay. And I wanted to start with a very simple Ant script because it's really easy to see when Ant's files begin small. The ModelGlue framework starts with a copy of what's known as an application template. This is just a directory that contains some code, index.cfm, application.cfm. Whenever you make a new copy of this, there's a few things that need to happen. You need to go through this and change the application name, probably change the data source name, and a few other things along the way. And you could do this by copy and paste, open up three files, and do a search and replace. But I can write a batch file to do that really quickly with Apache Ant. And all this is XML stating that this is the beginning of a new Ant project with the project tag. Ant uses a series of tags called properties to set variables that can be used throughout this task. Or throughout this project, sorry, not task. In this case, I'm setting two properties, one named source and the other named target, stating I'm copying everything from this source directory, so I have the actual path to that directory in there, and the target is this other directory. Now you have a task called target. A target in Ant is kind of like a subtask in this overall project, and you can build chains of dependency where for one target to happen, others need to happen first. So it'll look at this target tag and see a depends attribute and run the other ones that are cited in depends. However, this is a very simple Ant task. It simply has one target, and its name is build. Up at the top in my project tag, I've stated the default target to run is build. So as soon as this starts up, it's going to start, move to this target tag, and start looking at the actual tasks inside of that. And the tasks are very logical. I have a tag called copy. That copies files or directories. I can say copy to dir, which directory I want to copy to, that property target I set at the top, and what to copy falls inside of there. Copy a set of files, that's everything inside of this source directory. When you're done doing that, go run another task called replace. Go through all of those files and run a search and replace from this token called Model Glue Application Template to another token like blog, say I'm writing a new blog site. To run it, if you use CF Eclipse, it's a couple of keystrokes, Alt-Shift-X, Q, standard Eclipse run, and you'll see that it starts up the console and says it took 1 second to go ahead and execute. Now, build tasks do get a lot more complicated. This is one, the kind of style I promised I'd show, from that I've cleaned up a little bit up in my hotel room a few minutes ago. That's actually from a real application I do that's in production, where we wanted to have this situation I described earlier, where I can take a single revision number and say that this revision number is ready to build and ready to go to QA. In this case, I'm setting some properties at the top, which are how Ant should log in to Subversion. I'm going to integrate Ant with Subversion in this case. The username, the password, the URL of the Subversion server, and then what revision we want to build. I'll set up a few more properties that are what directories to use during this build. And the first thing that runs is this concept of create archive directory, which creates the whole directory structure I'm going to need inside of my build, using this tag called make directory. It's almost just like the DOS command or Unix command. Another one called create environment, which does a command line task over to Subversion, checking out all of the code from that revision. Then I can run a series of search and replaces, like shifting model glue to be in what's called production mode, making a clean copy of it, getting rid of any files I don't want, like any scrap Subversion files. And then I actually run a zip tag that zips all of that up really quickly into a zip file, copies that into sort of my destination directory for my zip, cleans up all of those scrap files, and then at the bottom I have another command line task that commits that Subversion or commits that new zip file right back into Subversion. It's just batch scripting, but in a nice structured way where you can use some variables throughout your batch file to automate these tasks. It took me about 4 or 5 hours to go from, I've heard of Ant, I should probably use it, but I'll check it out when I have time. One day I had time, it took like that 4 or 5 hours to go from there to about here, using Subversion to actually manage all of my builds. Okay, that's the two reach activities I had set up for this to show a few of the tools actually in use. I'd like to open up for any questions and just leave contact information up here. Yes? Correct. I am not completely certain of script text functionality. I've been using HTML edit format for a while. I'd probably recommend the documentation so that I don't misquote how it works. Yeah. Yes?
In a CF server environment where you want to see one CF server to access files across multiple file servers, how do you run MX7 if it's not system-bound?
I've actually done this on clustered hosting environments where I've used, are you in Windows or is this Unix? Okay. In Windows, I've used Active Directory accounts that have rights to those different files and to those shares on the different servers. Okay, the way I've gotten it to work, I'm trying to remember, this was about 3 or 4 years ago. I wasn't using dedicated NT sharing. I was using a network-attached storage device that was just for like high-end file sharing between things. One thing you could, is this for like file uploads that need to go off onto different servers? Or
And reads.
I would have to go into NT authentication stuff and read about that more to help you out and get that working. I don't think even anyone at Microsoft completely understands Active Directory authentication across file systems anymore. Hey, other questions? Back.
The last thing that you did with Ant was it was actually copying files, correct?
Right. The last. Are you talking about the last? Sorry. The question was.
The Ant script
The question is, was I using Ant to copy directly from Subversion to a production environment? And the answer there is no, I wasn't. I was copying them to my local file system and building a zip file. I typically don't handle actual deployments. I build code that I can give to somebody who's in systems administration who knows nothing about Cold Fusion. They can then unzip and place on their server. Other questions? Yes? Am I speaking about Model Glue Unity at all while I'm here? I'm going to try to sneak in either the weblog in 15 minutes demo or another demo nobody's really seen yet, unless you've watched my blog for the past few days, to the end of the MVC for you and me talk. Yeah. Or just catch me in a common area and I'll try to do it there too. Okay, other questions? All right. Sorry, one more. A copy of this build file? Sure, just email me. I'll send it off to you. Okay, well, thank you all very much for attending. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you for listening, and we hope we will see you at CF United 2007. This has been a production by TerraTech Programming. For more information, go to www.cfunited.com.